This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov, just continuing our theme of some of the stories that's come out of the 12-day war. A story has emerged about an Israeli F-15 fighter jet that actually malfunctioned while it was in Iranian airspace. And we understand that what happened in this particular case is that a fuel tank, one of the fuel tanks of the fighter jet, malfunctioned such that the plane wasn't actually able to utilize the fuel in that tank. And given the distance that the Israeli jets had to fly from Israel to Iran and back again, obviously they needed all the fuel they could use, they could have at their disposal. And there were cases when refueling aircraft were used to allow planes to travel that distance and back again safely. So obviously, this F-15 in Iranian airspace already with the fuel tank malfunctioning is not a good situation. And what's more, we understand that in this particular mission, there actually wasn't a fuel jet, a refueling aircraft accompanying these fighter jets. And so plans were quickly scrambled to somehow get a refueling aircraft to rendezvous with that F-15 that was experiencing its problems. I'm not sure how exactly that could have happened, because traditionally the refueling planes are much slower in the speed that they travel than the F-15s themselves. But somehow, and of course, we're not getting all the parts of the story here, but somehow there was a rendezvous that refueling aircraft did manage somehow to intercept with the F-15 in Iranian airspace, and the crisis was averted. We understand that there had already been plans made for that particular jet in trouble to potentially land in a neighboring country. We're not told which country, a neighboring country to Iran, in order to avoid the possibility of that plane coming down in Iran, to have to land in Iran, and obviously to risk the crew who were on board that plane. But part of the story also reveals the fact that apparently the head of the Israeli Air Force, Ronen Bar, had made an assessment that Israel could lose up to 10 aircraft in the 12-day war. We didn't know that it was going to be 12 days, but before the attack on Iran was actually made, and there was an assessment that up to 10 Israeli aircraft could be lost in the battles. And obvious arrangements had to be made and pilots briefed as to what they would do in the event that their aircraft would somehow have to go down in Iran. Obviously, the crew are able to eject from the aeroplane, but that's only half the issue. The rest of the issue is where do they land and what happens thereafter. And these pilots had all been trained and briefed and were ready for the possible event that they would have to land in Iranian territory and what they would do after that. Of course, we now know with the benefit of hindsight that no Israeli aircraft were lost at all in this particular battle, which is, I think, great testament to the skills of our pilots and to the ability of the Israeli Air Force in general, the success that they have, and the fact that no aeroplanes were lost at all during the battle. But we have no real idea when all of these activities were going on, the attacks were being carried out against Iran, what was going through the minds of the aircraft personnel planning the attacks, and of course through the minds of the crew who were sitting in the cockpit having to deal with these onboard emergencies.
It's just amazing that as we hear more and more about these stories. Let's talk about what is happening in Syria in terms of the Druze, the Syrian government, and the IDF. What do we know about Israel's intervention in this area?
Well, yesterday things really escalated after we chatted yesterday morning, and I mentioned the fact that the Syrian government forces were attacking Druze in the area, particularly of the city of Suwayda, which is in southern Syria, not too far from the Israeli border. And yesterday, after we spoke, things escalated further with many, many Syrian government forces going into Suwayda, killing some of the Druze there. The Druze were all taking up arms in order to protect themselves and their city. There were horrendous stories and videos circulating of Syrian government forces trying to humiliate Druze sheikhs by cutting their moustaches off in order to try to humiliate them. It kind of harks back to those stories that we heard from the Holocaust, where the Nazis took some joy in shaving beards of rabbis off in public in order to somehow try to humiliate them, in order to disarm them of their traditions. And that's exactly what was happening yesterday in Suwayda, with the Syrian government forces trying to cut the moustaches of their Druze clerics off in public. But then the IDF intervened more forcefully, and within a few hours of hearing of this massive attack carried out in Suwayda against the Druze, we all of a sudden hear that Syrian government forces are withdrawing from Suwayda. They're being not willingly withdrawing, but they're being forced to withdraw from Suwayda because the IDF had got involved. There were aircraft that had been deployed in order to bomb Syrian government forces. Then we heard towards the end of the day that things had sort of seemed to calm down a little bit. The chaos that had begun in the early part of the day somehow seemed to dissipate, and it seems as if the intervention of the IDF somehow convinced Syrian government forces that they didn't particularly want to pursue that line of action any longer. We didn't hear too much about any significant casualties, although there were casualties, but we understood that Syrian government forces were forced out of Suwayda and to be forced back again. And as I said yesterday, the Israeli government and the IDF has really two main objectives, two main interests that they're pursuing. First of all, to be good, to stand true to the promise that has been given to the Druze community in Israel about their Druze members of their family and brethren in Syria, that Israel will stand up and protect them from any danger, because they're a relatively small community and they don't really have the wherewithal to be able to defend themselves against attacks like the type that we saw yesterday. We also know that the Druze community have been immensely loyal to the State of Israel, that they serve in the IDF, that they're good citizens, and the Israeli government has promised them that they in turn will be protected, not only those living in Israel, but indeed those living in Syria as well, who were separated just by virtue of the way that the border was cast between the two countries. And of course, the second interest is that Israel doesn't want Syrian government forces landed on its border right there in southern Syria. And so there is a good interest to push them away and to allow the Druze to continue to conduct their lives, and potentially to keep a kind of a safe barrier along that border. So those are really the two interests. And yesterday we heard more statements by Israeli government ministers and members of the IDF saying that we will protect the Druze. And yesterday was a great example of Israel coming in and really saving what could have been a massacre in Suwayda.
Incredible. Absolutely unbelievable. Let's talk about the ultra-Orthodox parties. They are threatening to leave the coalition. That is over the Haredi draft bill. Let's understand a little bit more about that.
So this things came to a head yesterday because Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has nominated Yuli Edelstein, a member of his party, to conduct the negotiations with the ultra-Orthodox parties to somehow bring to an end the issue of the ultra-Orthodox draft. Now, for those people who haven't been following the story closely, I'll try to summarize it just in a few words. Back in 1948, David Ben-Gurion, then Prime Minister of Israel, came to an agreement with the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel that they would not be required to serve in the IDF so long as their individuals, their youth who are being exempt from the army, are learning in recognized institutions of Jewish learning, yeshivot. That was the agreement back in 1948. This agreement covered a very, very small number of people who were full-time students in yeshivot. Since then, and over the last almost 80 years, that number has grown substantially. And the amount of government money that has been invested in these yeshivot in order to keep them going has also grown substantially. And the divide in our society has grown alongside the growth in this particular situation, because more and more people are feeling that the ultra-Orthodox youth should be required to serve our country in some way, shape, or form, the same as every other person of a similar age who is not potentially in a recognized institution of ultra-Orthodox learning. And we have examples where secular youth go to universities, but they do that after they've served in the army. We have examples where modern Orthodox youth serve in the army, and some of them even combine that with religious learning through the so-called Hesder program, where they have religious tuition alongside their military service, and that is all found to be perfectly manageable and acceptable. So why the exception for the ultra-Orthodox youth? Well, that's a question that we can't really answer right now, but it's a persistent issue that goes on in our society and continues to divide us, and divides us even more when we're in a situation like we are now, where there is a shortage of personnel for the IDF, and we need soldiers and we need people to join in order to keep our country safe. And there are tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox youth who are not only getting exemption from the army, many of them are not even attending the institutions of religious learning as they're required to do. And what's more, there's government money being used to actually fund those institutions, and we get really nothing in return. People feel that there is no two-way flow of responsibility in terms of the ultra-Orthodox youth serving the country as much as the government is helping them. And so the ultra-Orthodox parties have traditionally over the years joined the government and been willing to prop up the government in order to support the coalition when there aren't enough members of the Knesset to support a particular government, in return for which they traditionally demand large sums of money to fund their ultra-Orthodox learning programs, and they demand continued exemption from military service for their youth. That has now come to a head. The High Court of Justice has ruled on this matter, saying that it is not legal to continue this particular program and that ultra-Orthodox youth are required to go to the army. That is the current law. And the IDF have been calling up ultra-Orthodox youth, and they have been failing to turn up in droves in very, very significant numbers. And so Yuli Edelstein has been nominated by the government to somehow resolve this program, because Prime Minister Netanyahu wants the ultra-Orthodox parties to remain satisfied in the coalition in order to prop him up as Prime Minister. If they leave the coalition, there is a good chance that his government will fall because it will not have a sufficient support in the Knesset. That's where we stand right now, and they are continually, the ultra-Orthodox party is continually threatening to leave the coalition and potentially bring down the government if this issue is not resolved. Yuli Edelstein yesterday stood up finally and he said, look, I am not willing to be swayed to allow blanket exemption for ultra-Orthodox youth. My position remains that we need to come to an arrangement where there is a gradual introduction of ultra-Orthodox youth to the IDF to call up to do national service of some sort or another, even if we don't require all of them to do it all at once, but gradually we increase the number. And the ultra-Orthodox parties are digging in their heels and being very, very difficult about how many youth should be called up, and what the consequences might be if they don't adhere to their side of the bargain. If the youth refuse to turn up for their military service, what happens next? And those consequences are part of the issue that we find ourselves in today, because we can't decide whether they should be denied money or they shouldn't be denied money, whether the youth should go to jail like all other youth will be required to do if they don't serve in the army. These are the issues which are really occupying us and potentially could bring down the government. And now there is even talk of potentially of an election between now and January of next year, with some sort of an eye on the possibility that the ultra-Orthodox parties will indeed leave the government, bring down the government, and force a general election, which some people are saying may not be such a bad idea. The risk for the ultra-Orthodox parties is if they bring the government down and they force an election, they may not be part of the next government, and they may lose out everything that they've managed to negotiate so far on the introduction of ultra-Orthodox youth to the army. The next government might just say, forget about all the deals, you all go to the army or go to jail. That is a potential threat that hangs over their heads right now.
That is where we leave it. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. 061-895-1019. I'd love your feedback. You can catch Anthony tomorrow morning at 7:45.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.